Hi, Kabir. Is it pronounced perfectly first?
It depends. It's like Kabir, but
Kabir.
I live in England where people can't say this, so it's Kabir.
Kabir. Kabir.
Yeah.
Welcome to AXFM. And now the most important question. What was your first computer?
It was a ZX Spectrum 48.
Not bad.
So that probably tells a bit about my age.
Yeah, you look like 30, so 30 years old, something like this, right? And with the rubber keys, right?
Yeah.
The black one.
So I guess I mostly use it to play games on, but sort of dabbled a bit with the basic stuff. I think I wrote.
What was your first favorite game? Or maybe even more interesting, what was the first game you ever played on the ZX Spectrum, you know?
Oh, gosh, I can't really remember. But I remember being really good at Bomb Jack and finishing that.
Bomb Track? I think
Bomb
I
Jack.
Bomb Jack, yeah.
Yeah.
Jack or Track. But I remember it was a great sound, actually, and the graphics were better than expected on ZX Spectrum. This is what I remember.
Yeah.
But this Bomb Jack was not like popular game, right?
It used to be like an arcade game.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. But I remember it was not hard to play, what I remember. And the graphics were nice. And what I also remember, the sound was actually exceptional back then.
Yeah.
Not bad. So, and what was your trajectory from Bomb Jack to First Line of Code?
Right. So, this is like a bit of a detour. So I grew up in Norway, so then I went to London to study. And in Norway, when you're good at school, you kind of become an engineer, an economist, or a doctor. But nobody really tells you about that there's different kinds of engineering. So I just applied for some engineering stuff in London, which was material science and engineering. It lasted 3 years. It wasn't really my favorite thing, so a bit of advice before would have been good. And then I sort of found myself having finished, but not really wanting to work with this. And then I had a year out. And then there's this record shop, which was really big in Piccadilly Circus, called Tower Records.
Uh-huh.
And it's like an American chain, I think. But I had like this big...
It's about here. Music?
Yeah, all music. But it had like 4 or 5 floors, I think.
Wow.
And then one day I went in there, and then they had these multimedia kiosks, which I'd never seen before. Because in England, you like have to just buy music, you can listen to it. And then you could like listen to songs, you could like read a bit about the artists, etc. It was kind of just before I'd really seen the internet. So I was like, wow, I want to work with this. And then I went back to the university careers advisor and said, I want to do multimedia. And she said, like, don't do multimedia. It's really fluffy, but do conversion masters in computing science. And I did that. And that was a much better fit than my degree.
Okay. So it means the Tower Records and music was the best career advice for you.
Yes, exactly.
What interests me is how was in Norway? So to grow up in Norway, was it fun? What about, you know, the dark days or what? How was it?
It was nice. Actually, I was born in England, but then we moved to Norway when I was 6.
Okay.
And apparently, according to my mother, one of the first things I said when I moved to Norway was like, oh, I don't want to go back to England. It's always just grey and miserable. So Norway's nice. You're a kid. It's like we grew up, well, first just a little bit outside Oslo and then really on the edge of Oslo. So there's lots of nature. In summer, it's great. You kind of go out cycling with your friends, go swimming. There's like lakes everywhere.
It's summer it's better than in England? Or is it
You can have like good weather between May and August, but it's variable. Like it can be crappy or it can be really good, but when it's really good, it's nice. So yeah, it's near the sea, you can go swimming.
Yeah, what's the difference to England then? Is it similar or is it is nice in England?
I think it's nicer in Norway because In London, when it gets hot, it's just hot. You can't really do anything apart from
Okay.
stand outside a pub or sit in the park. But sitting in sunbathing without any water for me doesn't really feel right.
Okay. But yeah, but in
And
England there would be
in
also some
winter,
locations with sea, right? I mean, this would be a similar experience.
yeah, but I don't really go there very much.
Okay.
And the few times I've tried to swim in England in the sea, it's freezing.
Oh.
In Norway, it actually gets warm because it's like all fjords, which are kind of sheltered, so they get a chance to warm up.
This is an incredible insight, actually, that in Norway
Yeah.
there is a warmer seas than or lakes than in England. Not bad.
I probably wouldn't recommend it for a beach holiday, but when you live there, it's nice.
Yeah, not that all flights get rerouted from
Yeah.
Hawaii to Norway right now after the
Yeah.
podcast, Yeah, pretty cool. So, okay, so but you enjoyed also the winter, if it was dark or not so.
Yeah, winter's fine. Like, well, it's cold, of course, but
Yeah.
and like now, I'm probably not as much a fan. But it's like November gets really dark, but then in February, in December, although that's even darker, then you have more chance of snow coming, which brightens things up. And when you're a kid, the snow is great. Like you ski and throw
Yeah.
snowballs and go sledging and oh yeah, they used to also spray all the football pitches in winter, so you go skating there in your
Okay.
neighborhood football pitch
Because
and
as a
stuff like
kid,
that.
I remember we're not allowed, to stay outside if there was dark. But I think in Norway it was a normal, right? So you can you always played outside when it was dark.
And it was like a while ago, so parents were less protective, so we just kind
Yeah.
of spend loads of time outdoors no matter the weather.
With torches and stuff, right? So you can have nice games.
Plus, there's also street lighting and stuff everywhere.
Yeah, sure. But if I were a kid, I would try to avoid the street lighting, and play somewhere else where it's dark for fun.
Yeah, but there's not really that many people around. It's quite
Okay.
not like, although it was like the outskirts of Oslo, it's still quite
Okay.
spread. But yeah, you know what I mean.
Yeah, sure. So, you restarted computer science. So, how long you had to study? Because you said it was like a conversion program, right?
Yeah, so the master's was basically only 1 year, so it was like it was really intensive. So it was like
Oh.
September until Christmas, introduction to everything, and then there's like 3 semesters in England, so like between Christmas and Easter. And then from Easter until summer, you'd share modules with the third year of computer science and then write a dissertation over the summer.
Okay. And this was
So,
it.
yeah. So,
So a very effective
it,
study, I would say. So you were actually
yeah, but it,
faster done than the others, right? Almost.
yeah. So it went well, but to be honest, I didn't really know what this was all about by the time I finished. So, when I got my first job, it probably took me like a year or two to kind of get the mentality of what we're actually building.
Yeah, this is normal. I would say this is your
Okay.
regardless of what you are studying, you are not ready for real world, I would say. But the first line of code, so what you implemented, was it basic or was it in which language, you started the programming and why?
In the university, you mean, or?
It regardless where. So you
Well,
had the ZX
so
Spectrum, so you only played
yeah, so
games
then
or you started
yeah,
to.
I did a bit of the basic that was
Hey,
built in.
cool. And why you did it? This is always an interesting question, no? So why you started to do basic if you had games? So this is the question.
Well, but I don't really know. I guess I was kind of always a bit geeky
Okay.
and interested in how things work. So I think most of my friends that had sort of computers didn't bother, but me and another friend were a bit more interested, so
Okay.
we did some simple programs. But then games seemed to be more fun, so
Yeah, sure.
that took
But what did you
over.
try to achieve with BASIC? So do you implemented something or?
Yeah, I think like not really much structured things. It was like more like, oh, cool that you can make the screen flash and stuff like this.
Yeah, but, exactly.
But I did write like a little, like I liked to cook when I was quite young. So I wrote a little cookbook on the Spectrum.
Okay.
But I think it just, I don't think it had like a database or anything like this. It just kind of had some how to make a grilled cheese sandwich hard-coded.
Yeah, with if else maybe, like because that. The databases was a mystery for me. So how you can persist something, right?
Yeah, and load it on tape.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know whether I managed to do this on with BASIC, but I think it was my first attempt on Pascal. So I was actually, I always asked the question, though, how to have something executable. This is what fascinated me. And how to store something so it doesn't go away, because anything else was just ephemeral, right? So you implemented something and then it just disappeared.
Yeah. Actually, Pascal was the first language we used in the masters.
Uh-huh.
And then a friend...
But you implemented something between the Spectrum and university, or was just, you know, you just restarted your passion?
I did nothing between then.
Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. Very good. So in the study you started, or you had to use Pascal?
Yeah. And then I remember one day they were like talk about records and files. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, what do they mean, files? And then a friend, she had a boyfriend who was doing a PhD. Mm-hmm. So he kind of knew lots about programming. So he was like helping me a bit out in the beginning. So I was like, do they actually mean files, like the files on the computer? Mm-hmm. And he was like, yes, that's exactly what it means. And that was like such a revelation to me at the time.
Yeah, for me it was the same. So for me, I also struggled with the idea, what is a binary file and what is a text file? Now, what are the different kind of files? So I remember files were a big deal for me as well. So
yeah, cool.
Yeah. And... what you did, do you have any, you know, side projects during your study, or you just, you know, focus? Oh, you just studied for 1 year effectively, right?
Yeah, so and it was really
intense. Yeah.
Quite intense. It was like probably like 20, 30 hours of lectures a week and then assignments and
Okay.
English university is a bit more like school compared to in Norway. Like in Norway, they seem to have very few lectures. Lots of self-study, whereas in England there's like tons of lectures and homework and stuff like this.
Which is better maybe, right? Or
yeah, I tried 1 year at university in Norway and it didn't really go very well because it was too... I need to be sort of motivated.
Yeah. Yeah.
Deadlines.
Uh-huh. Then what happened after the university, and what was your first line of Java code when it happened?
So Java came actually when, for my master's, my dissertation was when it was the year when Java just got introduced.
Uh-huh.
So my dissertation was like a Java applet, which had like some animation showing.
Ah, so you did dissertation about with Java?
Yeah.
Hey, cool. What was the topic or the title?
I can't really remember the title, but it was like an animation showing how the Motorola, some chip or other, kind of processes instructions.
Wow.
And it's like animating stuff between registries and the stack. And
this is actually not bad. So you could load something and adjust this was visualization of the CPU?
Yeah, very simple, but...
But still. For Motorola 68,000, I think, right?
Yeah, I think that's
68 or 86, I was...
It might be 80, I can't really remember.
This was the one famous Motorola, which was the which assembly language, which is based, you know, this was where what was a nice assembly language for the... 68,000, I think, was the 68K.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it worked well? Was it hard for you? To do that?
Well, the assembly stuff was okay, I think. But trying to do animations was quite hard.
Mm-hmm. And like were they nice, the animations, or is it like...
No, it looked really, really amateur.
It's actually cool. So you have to check in, you have to commit it to your GitHub account. Find it, you know, record a screencast and persist on GitHub.
Yeah, I think I have a copy of the dissertation somewhere. I don't know if I still have the code, but I think I printed out all the code to make it look a bit thicker.
Yeah, then you can rescan it. This would be actually pretty cool, no?
Yeah.
Yeah, you should do this right after the podcast.
Yeah, cool. Well, it's been my mum in Norway, so I'll have to wait till I go and see her.
Okay, cool. Then, okay, what happened after your university or after your dissertation?
Right, so I got... When I was still doing my master's, there was like some job adverts in the department, mm-hmm. computing department. And then I went for an interview, and so I had my first ever job lined up when I finished. So that was mm-hmm. quite near the university in London.
Mm-hmm. Tower Records, hopefully.
No, sadly not.
This would be cool, right? But this would be actually a cool story. You were hired by Tower Records and you revolutionized the entire department and met you two at the end. This would be the coolest cool. podcast ever.
Yeah. Sorry to disappoint.
I'm just joking.
Yeah, I know. Right, so that was like doing C++ on Windows NT servers. And it was like some kind of distributed system for streaming multimedia. Okay. Stuff.
But this is quite hard, I would say.
Yeah, my first ever task they gave me was to write, they gave me this book about WinSock and said, write an HTTP server. So that was my first task.
But this is not bad. This is like, you know, the first assignment for someone who has no idea about sports, just go to do triathlon or, you know, the Ironman.
Yeah. And I was like, okay, so I've written this and then, is this actually what goes on the web doing stuff? And they're like, yeah. And I was like, wow.
And you managed to implement an HTTP server in C++?
It was very simple. It's like just kind of like for management of these nodes in this.
Yeah, but even, you know, parsing the stuff in C++ is not easy. As I remember, there was not even a string, right? So these strings were zero, how to call it, the last character was zero, or I think zero, right? So there was zero terminated.
Null ending, yeah.
Or null. So.
Mm-hmm. I can't really remember if there's any difference. I haven't done much C++ since, but...
Yeah, me neither, but Java was actually the proper, you know, thing to get Java was to mention that, because Java had strings, so you didn't have to bother with the, you know...
I remember we were using something called T-string in this mm-hmm. project, which I think might have been a Microsoft thing.
Okay.
But I can't really remember what they were. Mm-hmm. It was some kind of wrapper thing with probably mm-hmm. operator overloads and stuff like this. Yeah.
I really like C++. I like C++, really. So, and if I have time, I will actually read the Björn Strustrup books as well, just for fun, actually. I really like them. And then Java came, but I would need a little bit more time, and I will, you know, just play with C++ again, just for fun. Because the operator overloadings, say in and say out and templates, I just like them for fun, not, you know, in a commercial project, just, you know, play with them.
Yeah, it definitely seems really powerful. So mm-hmm. I felt really comfortable in C++ after a while, but... Mm-hmm. That's a long time ago now, so yeah. I'll probably.
But I only worked with Linux. I never used C++ on Windows. So, you know, I had to set up the GNU. I remember the GNU environment, and there was, I think, C++ was a macro which pointed to G++ or something like this. This was like the C++ was based on the C. This was like a wrapper around, but it's a long time ago. So, So I used this a lot and never used C++ somewhere else, always on Linux back then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so you implemented, your first assignment was writing an HTTP server with C++ on Windows, right? Not bad. So yeah. I'm curious about your second one. What was it? Create a small operating system?
No, I can't really remember, but another cool thing I did in that place was the real-time protocol had just come out.
Real-time protocol?
I think like RealPlayer, if you remember that.
Ah, yeah. Uh-huh.
Use this. So I wrote this thing which could stream music across the network, and then
almost Tower Records, right?
I mean, yeah, almost, yeah. Getting nearer.
Yeah, but it's also crazy streaming. I mean, not bad.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So it was a really interesting job. Sadly, it wasn't. This was my first job, so I didn't get paid very much. So I left after a year to get a bit more money.
Yeah, but you learned a lot, I guess, right?
Yeah.
And what was your reaction to C++? Because you knew Java before, right? So you missed Java there, or you were happy with C++?
Well, I think we did C++ in my course before we did Java. So Java kind of felt easier, but then I still had a bit of familiarity with C++. But yeah, it probably was a huge learning curve too.
Okay.
I mean, you come from like writing stupid little assignments to having to write write real software. So I think that's probably quite crazy, no matter which language you're using.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Your first job, I mean.
You said you only spent 1 year at the company with streaming music and building HTTP servers. So what happened afterwards? What was your next, station in your journey?
So then I worked a bit for a consultancy for like a year and a half, I think.
Mm-hmm. Java or no Java?
No Java there. They basically like threw onto projects for a few weeks or months, and you'd kind of have to use whatever language the project was using. So that was like a really good way to kind of get familiar with, or to see like how similar computing or programming languages are. Like once you know the fundamentals of one, they're quite easy transferable to others. So that gave me some confidence in my abilities. My longest project there was working on something using, it's called Active Server Pages.
Oh, this is similar to JSPs from Microsoft, ASPs and JSPs. But they were crazy successful, actually, on Microsoft ASPs. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it also used this thing called Microsoft Transaction Server.
Yeah.
Which is kind of MTS. Similar to
EJBs. Exactly. So there was similar transaction levels, and there was always another discussion what was first, MTS or EJBs. Exactly.
Yeah. And then after that, we're finally doing some Java again. So,
wow.
So I left this consultancy after a year and a half. Because it was like...
The main reason is, of course, because there wasn't no Java, right, in the company. So you had...
Yeah. So I went on strike. I had this like idea, like now that I've got so many skills in programming languages and stuff, I'll go freelancing.
Uh-huh.
But then I was a bit optimistic about how easy it would be to get my first gig. So that took a few months. So I stayed on the sofa of some friends while trying to get a contract.
Mm-hmm.
But then I finally got one, and it was for a company doing freight and services for the exhibition industry.
Okay.
And they wanted to have a website where which became like a .com thingy, where they would like provide information. Like if you're exhibiting at a trade show, you get sent a huge folder with like all the information and things you can order for your stand from various suppliers, which you would normally fax back these forms. So I was like the only developer for a long time. So the idea was to get this these exhibitor manuals online with the booking system and link into the suppliers. Mm-hmm. So, and they didn't really want to spend much money. So that's when, so we started off on Linux using a free version of Sybase, and I can't remember which runtime we used initially, but a JSP framework.
Tomcat, Java Web Server, JBoss.
It was something proprietary, actually, because I didn't really know much about Java at the time.
Then maybe Sybase had an application server as well.
Yeah, and it was something, a small company I've never really heard about before since.
Cool.
But so we got this like first version up and running, and then wrote a second version with everything we'd learned from the first one. And mm-hmm. I found out now that EJBs existed and they look like Microsoft Transaction Server and blah, 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 blah. And I think now there was like a proper Java EE spec. Mm-hmm. There might have been the first time. I don't really know. But
Which year was it roughly?
I think the second version we started maybe around 2001.
Wow. Okay, this is really early. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So for the second version, we started using JBoss, or I decided we should use JBoss. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so the second version was much better and more properly architected.
Was it complete rewrite, or was just porting incrementally from the
first? It was a total rewrite.
Okay.
And then
yes, you were brave. So I tried to avoid total rewrites. I tried to do it always, you know, incrementally.
Yeah, but I mean, I didn't really have that much experience, so mm-hmm. and I was young and optimistic, and this rewrite will take 3 months, and it took like a year and a half. But
okay, not bad actually.
Uh-huh. And then I had like a small team of people helping, mm-hmm. so that was good.
And it worked well,
huh?
It worked well at the end?
Yeah. Cool. This worked much better. And it was more maintainable. Like the first version to set up all these forms that people have to fill in. Mm-hmm. Like the people who are told them how to enter data in the database directly. They would like also delete stuff by accident, just like get backups, things like this. So the second version actually had like a proper UI for the people setting up the sites.
Yeah, this is actually funny because almost at the same time, I implemented similar system for selling trumpets, and the sales people. I forced them first to use the database directly. This was Oracle, and I said it's not a big deal, you know. It's insert, select, and never use delete, basically. And they say, no, they cannot do this. Like, why not? I mean, this is insert, and I just provide some examples. And then we had to implement like an admin interface. It was, of course, terrible, but we used the Java web server. And this is from there we implemented it. Not a framework, it's more like abstractions of JDBC and something like EJBs, but without EJBs, because Java web server was just the servlet engine, right? But similar story to yours, but it was musical instruments. I don't know whether it was setting or just a catalog. So, yeah.
Oh, nice. Cool.
Yeah. And so this was the your freelance gig, right? So you were the freelancer 1.5 year working with JBoss then. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, but it actually became... It became a permanent job in the end. So, but on a much better salary than I'd had before doing the freelancing part. So that was good. So we used it. Like we did actually run into some problems at some stage. So then we got JBoss support. Mm-hmm. And I got like, wow, they know everything, blah, blah. And then I thought, maybe I should try to work there one day. And so I ended up there eventually.
But how? I mean, so you were hired by JBoss or by Red Hat?
By JBoss.
Wow. Okay. This is a great story. But how they found you, actually?
So in 2004, when I sort of decided I'd like to work, because this other company was like really interesting for me, but I'd been there for a while and it wasn't really that great an environment. And I wasn't really learning much from anybody. I was like the expert, but I wasn't that experienced or had much to learn from. So in 2004, I started contributing to something called JBoss Mail, which some guy started. But then I had little, and then I also started working on JBoss AOP. And I was back in Norway at the time.
But
And that,
why you did it? Why JBoss AOP and why JBoss Mail? So, I mean, how you got the idea to contribute anything to this?
I was looking to find a way to contribute too. And the guy doing JBoss Mail was really like active and shouting about it. And AOP just kind of sounded like something new and space age. So I kind of did a bit on that as well. And then I was actually back in Norway for a while then. And then I got to know like this company called Conduct, who were the first ever, the world's first ever JBoss partner. And then they had an event with Sacha Labouri, who was like one of the head guys at JBoss, doing a talk. So I managed to have a little conversation with him. So he said, like, focus on AOP if you want a job, like forget JBoss Mail. But essentially, I think I had a job offer the next week anyway, because I'd had some contributions already. Unfortunately, it was a hiring freeze, so I had to like wait a few months. But then in I think September 2004, I finally joined.
JBoss. Yeah, not
And
bad.
then a month or two later, I think it was, then we all flew to Atlanta and I met everybody. And I think there were like only 50 people in the whole company or something like this.
50 people.
Yeah, it's very small.
I had a podcast already with the founder of JBoss. You had a chance to listen to it.
Mark Fleury.
Yes.
I haven't listened to it yet. No. Is it recent or old?
I'm just searching for the date with Mark Fleury. Maybe 2 years old or something. It's not like
Okay.
not that old.
Yeah, like newer
Oh, yeah,
than.
it is from, this is number 98 in 2020, so 5 years
Okay.
old. And this
Yeah.
is the podcast number 98, Walk the Path, How JBoss Happened. And the funny story is, I explained Mark at the end how Quarkus is working and how JBoss became Quarkus, and he was really interested in it. So this was actually a funny story at the end
Cool, maybe
that
you'll contribute.
we had also we had a nice discussion about Richard Oebeck and Sacha Labouri, Scott Stark, and stuff like that. So it was actually really interesting to talk with him. He's a really nice guy and interesting guy.
I think like when we that first visit in Atlanta, there was one evening we all went to his house and had pizza in his garden.
Oh, and he was a special forces guy, right? So this is an interesting story.
Yeah, it was some kind of commando
Yeah,
thing.
commando with math combined with math, which is even crazier. Super cool. So you interacted also with Mark.
Yeah, but then I mean, after, yeah, so in the beginning he was around quite a lot. But then, of course, I think the Red Hat acquisition happened in 2006, and then he
Okay,
left
2 years ago.
quite soon after.
And since then, you are working for Red Hat, right?
Yeah, although now it's IBM.
Okay.
So
Yeah, sure. But
the whole runtimes division moved to IBM last year.
And in JBoss, you worked on AOP full time?
Yeah, so initially I worked on JBoss AOP. Bill Burke, who started the AOP project, then moved on to the spec for EJV3. And the early implementation we had was very, very like based on JBoss AOP. So I also did quite a bit on the EW3 implementation, this initial one.
The cool story is the very first EJB implementation on JBoss I use as a home automation. So I wanted to have a real world, you know, project proof of concept to see how it is working. So I picked a JBoss and the very first EJB3 implementation. It was so early that even the packages were wrong. It was not like JavaX EJB. I remember the first one was wrong. It's like maybe even comJBoss or something, but not JavaX.EJB.
Yeah.
But it worked.
But maybe because I think initially, like, I think they weren't really allowed to call themselves EJB because of some licensing stuff.
Yeah, EJB Boss, there was the name, right? The original name was EJB Boss, and then was some problems, and
And then they had to, like, do the TCK, which I think they just finished by the time I joined or something like this.
But the cool story is, it worked well, the home automation. The automation, there was actually heating control, so the name was Greenfire. And I think I won at least one competition with that innovation prize because I was able to save some energy. And it ran on JBoss and EJB3.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and people still ping me. I remember the Greenfire thing you did. It's like, yeah, it was actually cool. And but it was not that complicated. No, I read these sensors and took a look, you know, whether the sun shines on or not, and was able to control the heating basically with if else loaded Groovy on demand. This was the automation script, and this basically, as of now, it would be an agent. Yeah, I could actually migrate it to an agent and see what happens. Maybe not that smart, but it could work, right?
If you were to save energy.
yeah, of course. Maybe it would save my energy, but the total energy would be not, you know, would be not.
Outsource it.
Perfect. So interesting story. So you became EJB3 committer, right? So what I remember. So what is it right now? So from AOP to EJB3.
No, but AOP was still my main responsibility.
But so was the AOP on JBoss was a set of interceptors first? So I remember calling an EJB to like 12 different interceptors. Is this what you worked on the interceptor chain or a bytecode manipulation?
So I worked more on the bytecode manipulation, but I think the idea at the time was like before the AOP stuff came along, there were like lots of different kinds of interceptors. There were like one kind of interceptors for the EJB client, one kind for the server interceptors, one kind somewhere in JMS.
Remote caching.
There were lots of different interceptors with a different interface. So the AOP interceptor at the time became the standardized one.
Okay, and in which version was it standardized? You remember in JBoss?
I think
after 3. Yeah, exactly. Because 3, there was still the invocation chain, or how to call it, this invocation handler chain.
Yeah, I think maybe in 4.2, if that existed, they'd started migrating to some of the things.
Because it was nice with the there was an XML file, and you can actually take a look how the EJB container is working, because you saw the interceptors, right? You saw, okay, this is remote, this is the first one, and then I cannot remember, but I remember for entity beans, there were like 12 different interceptors, or lots of them. So and you stick with AOP, or what was your next step?
Right, so I was like leading the AOP project for a few years.
Cool.
Then we were going to do JBoss 5, which was based on a new kernel called the microcontainer. So I was a bit involved with that. Unfortunately, this was kind of over-engineered. So JBoss 6 was like much slower to start up than JBoss 5. So I spent some time optimizing that, but still it was still slow.
Same happened to Glassfish. Glassfish V2 started fast, and V3 was more modular, but was slower to start.
Yeah. So then, I can't remember the year, it's a long time ago, but at some stage, a small group of engineers on the team had like a special mission to kind of like come up with like a faster container and like rethink the whole server. So once they came live with their prototype, I joined the team. And this is like what was the architecture now for Wildfly. And so it's like the modernized things. I've been involved with that since almost the beginning.
Wow. And are you still working on it?
I'm still involved in Wildfly and EAP, of course. But a bit less now because I'm doing more work on the A2A stuff.
And have you worked on either, wait a second, management or deployment?
Yeah, so when I was working in Wildfly, I was really working on like the core server management structure. And also initially the domain management stuff. We have like the domain server and host controllers and them controlling lots of different servers.
But maybe I'm confusing you with someone else, but is it possible that you wrote me an email asking me about a standard related back then, you know, to management or monitoring or metrics? Because I was surprised that you asking me because I was not involved in the spec, you know. You asked me something, or maybe I was. So we had a short interaction, I remember.
There was some kind of spec that was...
short-lived spec.
Like 10 years ago or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Like he was... it's like this guy from Oracle who wanted to... instead of having JMX doing... I can't really remember, but...
Yeah, yeah, it was a replacement of JMX, like a management spec.
And
and you pinged me, and I also had no idea because I'm never worked for Oracle. I was just, you know...
I thought you were on the spec, so...
Maybe I was, but I had no insight because I think this is the where Java E happened, Java E 8 happened, and Oracle was on vacations for 1 year, so nothing happened there. Maybe this was, you know, this...
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So I would say agent to agent is the cliffhanger. So I have to talk with you about agent to agent because A2A is, interestingly, Quarkus is the reference implementation from the specification published by Google. This is the agent to...
Slight correction. It's the reference implementation for the Java implementation.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean... super cool. But I mean, Java is the most popular language on Earth, right? So, I mean, there's...
but we also have Python and...
Yeah, we don't have to talk about this on the podcast. Yeah, Python and Node.js and Visual Basic. There are different languages, but super cool. So Quarkus is the reference implementation for agent-to-agent spec. And if you go to the... you search for agent-to-agent protocol, you will find GitHub repository. And then the reference implementation, and then how I learned about that. So I was interested in the A2A. Then Java code, click on Java, it's like application scope, this is what I know, it injects, it looks familiar, and then I found it is Quarkus, and this is actually crazy.
Yeah. and we actually have like a Wildfly Extras repository as well, where we have this deployable in Wildfly as well.
Because I think this is we won't manage to cover A2A today, but what we will do, this will be cliffhanger. I re-invite you back for one A2A Quarkus episode, if you like.
Okay, yeah.
Because I already tried that with Quarkus and used that, and it worked, so we can have a talk what it can do with it, and it works really nicely. So, maybe to... as a cliffhanger, as a proper cliffhanger. To me, A2A is more like maybe microservice specification for agents. So what you can do with A2A is you can implement an agent with an agent card, which is more or less like Vizdl in SOAL. It's like, you know, these are my capabilities. It's like your business card. And another agent can look it up. And then you can have bidirectional communication between both agents, right? This is what... with different protocols, which are advertised as well, right?
Yeah, so there's like three protocols in the spec, like JSON RPC, REST, gRPC. you could also have more, whatever you like, but these are like the standard ones in the spec. So, so it's basically like a way for agents to call other agents to get help with something they don't necessarily know themselves and to act on behalf of the user. And it's great to have like a standard protocol rather than if you have like company A's agents talking their own protocol, company B's agents talking their own protocol, and it's like if you want to write an application, you'll have to like implement so many protocols. So it's kind of an attempt to standardize it into one language, basically.
If you take a look at the specification, A2A or the implementation, it reminds me a little bit of Corba, Genie, and so on. So this is the mix of, you know, all the technologies which come to mind.
Yeah.
But maybe why it's so important to have agents, and there are pragmatic reasons, because, you know, if you listen to the AI architects right now, it seems maybe a bit over-engineered. But from my perspective, an agent is absolute suitable thing to do, is because if you would attempt to have one big AI application, it's really hard to tell what the application is actually doing, because it's way too complex. But if you have smaller agents, what it can do is you can easier trace the activities of the agents, then the context window is smaller, so it works better with LLMs. Every agent can have a different LLM, so you are more flexible. And also you can have, you know, in the backend, like enterprise agents, which are exposing enterprise systems. In the front end, you can have an orchestrator agent with complete different tasks. So I would say it is more manageable and easier to implement and easier to test. This is maybe the opposite to real microservices, where one monolith is sometimes better than five different microservices. In my opinion, in agent world, it is better to have simpler prompts, simpler agents, simple interaction with LLMs than have one huge prompt, because LLMs are not that predictable, right?
Yeah, so like you can like specialize and tune the prompts for each agent.
Exactly.
So this one's an expert at fraud detection. This one's an expert at translating or whatever.
Okay, perfect. So I would say next time we talk just about A2A, right?
Okay, cool.
Where people can find you on social media, internet? In pubs?
I am on Twitter, but I don't really use it much anymore.
I will put it to the show notes. Yeah, but Kabir, as to exactly pronounced perfectly,
yeah,
Kabir Khan.
Yeah.
Okay, is your name. And people will find you on Twitter, you said, I guess in all the GitHub repositories. So if you go to A2A, you are the most active A2A committer.
Oh, cool. I didn't realize.
Yeah.
So on GitHub, I'm just Kabir.
Kabir, okay.
I got in early, so I didn't. I got
Very good.
My first name.
And next time we talk just Quarkus A2A and maybe a little bit open telemetry. It's also part of agents, right? So a little bit traceability. It's also nice.
Yeah, we've added or are adding this. So, yeah.
Yeah. Perfect. Thank you. And see you next time.
Okay. Thank you.